Welcome to That Medic Podcast, your bi-weekly dose
of all things digital health, global health, and leadership.
My name is Success, a student at Cambridge University.
And I'm Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
Join us as we chat with some top professionals in healthcare. Enjoy.
In this podcast, we spoke to Dr. Amit Breck, Chief Health Officer of Included Health. We discussed the most significant challenges facing the U.S. healthcare system and their diverse experiences across consulting, law, med tech, and beyond. Across our conversation, she emphasized how it's easy to point out problems, but it's more important to have a vision for the future. Today's show is perfect for anyone excited about leveraging technology to change healthcare, or just intrigued about population health generally. So, without further ado, let's have a listen. Hi, Dr. Parekh. Welcome to the show, and thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with us. So we normally start the podcast by asking the question, why did you decide to study medicine?
Yeah, Simmer, thank you so much for having me. I think this podcast is great in getting people motivated to work on healthcare. So thank you for doing this podcast, and thank you for having me. So I am probably a little bit atypical in that I didn't know I wanted to be a doctor for a while. When I went to college, I thought I was going to be a German and English major. And, you know, was working down that path. But while I was in college and I went to a liberal arts school, I realized that actually my passion for science and my passion for people and making people better came together really nicely in medicine. That being said, I wasn't totally convinced, and I worked for McKinsey first. But while I was at McKinsey in New York City, the World Trade Towers came down. And so I was in New York City on September 11th, working with a lot of people who worked in finance and consulting. And it was a pretty big moment for me where I realized that my career had to be dedicated to something much bigger than myself, and really focused on healthcare at that moment. And so that was really, I think, for me, the aha moment where it was clear that I wanted to spend my life in medicine, and then went on from there to go to Yale and actually become a doctor, which was very fun.
Right. No, that's incredibly fascinating. I mean, I can't imagine how terrifying it must have been to be in New York City when the towers came down. I know that after McKinsey, you went on to work a little bit for the Clinton Foundation. Could you tell me a little bit about that experience and why you wanted that to have, why you wanted to have that experience under your belt before you went to medical school?
Yeah, that was probably one of the most fun times of my career. And if I still reflect back on moments where I've probably impacted the greatest number of people in their health, my time at the Clinton Foundation is probably one of those. And so I had just, you know, worked at McKinsey for 2 years, and you know, McKinsey is great for many things, but I think what it really does is teach you how to think about big problems. How do you simplify the problem and then communicate potential solutions and, you know, really look at it from a breadth of perspectives. So the problem the Clinton Foundation was trying to solve is how do we get ARV drugs for HIV/AIDS to the least developed countries. And so my role there was to work with them to go to India and negotiate with the Indian generic pharmaceutical companies pricing to bring the pricing down when they purchase them for parts of Africa and other parts of the world. You know, the Clinton Foundation ended up reducing costs of those drugs by over 100%. And if you think about just the ability to take those drugs to for all of these people, price is a huge reason why they can't take them today. And so it was a great time in my life where I feel like something I had learned, a skill I had from McKinsey, and actually I used a little bit of my chemistry knowledge from like jobs I had had in high school, because we were trying to make sure the quality of these drugs was also good. So I could take skills that I had and bring them to a problem that would actually help a lot of people. And if I think about that Venn diagram of skill set with impact, there's nothing better than that when you think about careers. And so it was a great time for me.
Certainly. That's such an incredible story. I know that as you were mentioning, you went to Yale for medical school, but of course you're also trained as a MD-JD. So as you know, that's a pretty rare combination to see in healthcare. So I have to ask, why did you decide to study law as well?
It's a really good question. And if you ask my husband, he would just tell you that I really love school because, you know, we decided together that I could do the law school in addition to med school. Part of it was I love medical school. So I know medical school is hard and you spend a lot of time learning things. I really love medical school. And the thing I was most excited about was that third year of medical school when you start to actually take care of patients and see patients. And You know, I showed up bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, ready to help patients and ready to like really make a difference in people's lives. And I realized during my third year that no matter how much I worked to help patients, sometimes they didn't get the outcomes they deserved because our system was so fragmented, didn't incentivize the right behaviors, and policy was set up in a way that wasn't actually making patients better. I'll give you a couple examples. WIC, which is a program for mothers, would pay for a formula, but wouldn't pay for helping mothers learn how to breastfeed, right? I would take care of patients in the ICU with asthma exacerbations, but then they couldn't feel their inhalers afterwards or live in a smoke-free environment. And so they would come back. And so that is what prompted me to go to law school and to apply to Yale Law School, where I met really smart people and made great friends who are passionate about fixing lots of things in the world. But for me, it was really about understanding policy and regulation and the law and how it impacts everything we do in healthcare. So that plus the understanding the business of it from McKinsey, and then the clinical piece of it was really, I thought, a skill set I could bring together.
That's really interesting. And I imagine it must be incredibly frustrating for physicians to deal with the downstream consequences of decisions they didn't make. And it's a circular nature there. I want to talk to you a little bit more about how your legal background has informed your healthcare work across your career. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to specific instances where it's been helpful.
Yeah, I would say, I should be clear. After school, I went to residency and focused on becoming a doctor. I did not take the bar. I don't practice law and don't plan to at this moment in time. But I think if you think about McKinsey and law school and even medical school, all of these are different frameworks for thinking about large systemic problems. And so the benefit of going to law school was one, to understand that the law is gray and it is changeable. And so that is very helpful as you think about healthcare policy and that landscape. And two, to understand where you can push and where you can't push when you're trying to make transformative change. And so, you know, now I work at a healthcare technology and care delivery company, and just being able to understand like the why behind the law, because sometimes regulation can inhibit innovation. And so really understanding that push-pull came from, I think, my time in law school.
Right. So I want to go back to your internal medicine residency at Brigham and Women's Hospital. After that, you went to work at UCSF as the medical director of health systems innovation. I was wondering if you could talk to me a little bit about your work there, specifically as it relates to accountable care, and what you took away from just starting off in the academic environment.
Yeah. So as someone who was leaving residency, you know, for your first post-residency job, one of the things I was balancing was I did want to continue to see patients. And so I think that's important for people at that phase of their career to be really crisp on how much more patient care you want to do. I felt like at that point, I had spent my residency trying to become a really good doctor, and I wanted to continue to hone that skill and really be in attending and have that accountability for patients. So health systems are a great place where you can continue to see patients and sort of impact the greater system. The work I did there, and I loved my time there, I was there for 7 years, was really take a large academic medical center that focuses on tertiary coronary care and is mostly paid fee-for-service and start to tilt it towards taking value-based payment. And so during my time there, we were able to participate in 5 commercial ACOs. We were able to start taking Medicare shared savings programs. We participated in the Medicaid Prime program, which incentivizes outcomes more than just fee-for-service. And we launched our own regional limited Knox-Keene health plan, Canopy Health. And so all of those together started to have this health system take accountability for population-level outcomes and population-level total cost of care. And it was a really fun time.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And I know that you ultimately served as Chief Medical Officer of Population Health and Clinical Integration at UCSF Health. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more to that difference between the population health and the individual health, the difference between value-based payment and fee-for-service for some of our listeners who may not be as familiar with those distinctions.
Absolutely. So if you think about how most providers of healthcare get paid today, and unfortunately still today, they get paid by unit. So you go to see the primary care doctor, They get paid, you know, $150 to $300, depending on your insurance for that visit. You go get a lab. The lab gets paid for those labs. You get an x-ray. The x-ray facility gets paid for that x-ray. You see a specialist. They get paid. And everybody just gets paid for volume. And nobody actually gets paid for making sure that you, Simmer, are actually getting healthier or you are actually getting the outcomes that you deserve. So is your diabetes actually under control despite seeing the endocrinologist? Did you actually start to be able to walk fast after your x-ray, after you injured a part of your leg? Like those outcomes are not really incentivized in healthcare today. And so one of the ways, you know, it came through the ACA and other places, we believe that you can start to drive the outcomes that matter is through paying for those outcomes instead of paying by widget, for lack of a better word. You know, I think one of the most disturbing things in American healthcare is people are dying younger and more sick despite spending 20% of our GDP on healthcare. So at the macro level, that is why transitioning from fee-for-service towards value-based care might be able to sort of change that trend.
Right. And I know that now you are the chief health officer of Included Health. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about what exactly is Included Health and why did you decide to make the transition from UCSF, from this academic environment where you were doing this population health work, to this company, a more corporate environment?
Yeah. So why don't I tell you what Included Health is first, and then I'll tell you the why I transitioned. Okay. So Included Health is a relatively large company at this point. We're about 2,500 people across all 50 states. And we do healthcare navigation and virtual care. And you might say, well, what is healthcare navigation? So it really is helping people navigate the complexity that is the American healthcare system. For some of our clients who are mostly large self-insured employers or health plans, we're the phone number on the back of their insurance card. So we help them find a high quality in-network provider when they need to find one. We help them understand their bills and or advocate against their bills if they're too high. We help them with things like care, case, and disease management. And we also do expert medical opinions. In addition to that, we have 24/7 urgent care across all 50 states. We have behavioral health, which is both psychiatry and therapy. And we have virtual primary care across all 50 states as well. And so if you start to imagine it, it really is starting to bring together both the navigation of the current healthcare ecosystem and supply for some of the most supply poor parts of American healthcare, primary care, behavioral health for patients. And so we serve through navigation about 10 million Americans today, and you know, nearly 50 million people have access to our virtual care services. And it's been a really fun 4.5 years.
So now I'm curious about that transition then.
The why.
Yeah.
I'd say there's three main reasons I transitioned from UCSF Health to Included Health a little over 4 years ago. The first is, as you probably heard, my time before Included Health was not really on the tech side of healthcare. You know, I was on the population health side, trying to transform delivery systems to better lead to outcomes. And honestly, I probably complained about technology more than I worked within it. Because in some ways, tech had changed every other aspect of my life. I mean, I'm a working mom. I always have been. I could do things with technology to make my life easier. And yet in healthcare, like tech hadn't changed anything. If anything, it had probably made it more frustrating, right? If you think about the early days of the EHR, tech had actually made more barriers to access, had actually made things more difficult. And so from an accountability standpoint, part of the transition was, I should probably stop complaining about this and instead work for a place where I think we can actually use technology to transform healthcare in a way that it had in every other industry, take banking, take retail. So that was one reason. The second was actually alignment of incentives. So ultimately, most health systems continue to operate in a primarily fee-for-service world today. I do hope and think that will change over time. The nice thing about Included Health is we have very aligned incentives with our purchasers of care. So if you're a self-insured employer, you really want your population to stay healthy and to like be able to continue to work. And so that alignment of incentives helps then drive products that I think actually will improve the population's health. And then the third is just the diversity of people I get to work with. So as I think about, you know, I loved all the people I worked with at UCSF. but they were actually quite similar to me. They were often trained at great institutions. They came from a very clinical background. They worked in health systems. As I think about the people I work with today at Included Health, I mean, these are people who care just as deeply about healthcare, but came from Twitter, came from Cisco, have come from businesses that are just fundamentally different. And so they think about problems differently. They bring creative solutions. And, you know, healthcare is a team sport. And I think the more smart people we can get with a diversity of thought, thinking about it, the better. And so that was probably the third reason.
That's a great set of reasons. And, you know, a couple of reflections as you're saying that. It has been interesting what you said about how technology has sometimes complicated healthcare, right? The electronic health record or electronic medical record. I mean, nobody enjoys that, right? There's an idea called pajama time, where physicians take their electronic health record back home and they're coding or putting it away, just putting in the notes as when they should be sleeping, frankly. So it has been interesting. And then to just see how some of the technology that is meant to streamline things, make things easier, has really gone the other direction. You know, I want to go back to Included Health. And like, I understand that it offers a bold mission to raise the standard of healthcare for everyone. And that will, by necessity, if you want to target everyone, require confronting some pretty significant challenges facing the US healthcare system. As you mentioned, we spend 20% of our GDP on healthcare, but don't have the best outcomes. So I want to ask you, from your perspective, from your vantage point, what do you think are some of the most pressing and daunting challenges we're facing in healthcare?
Well, first of all, I might start by saying, in healthcare thinking, we often start with the problems, which I think is appropriate because there are a lot of problems. But I actually think if we frame that to say, what do we want the US healthcare system to look like? That might be a more informed way to like say, well, where are we trying to go instead of like, how are we trying to fix the problem? And so if I think about it that way, where I'm trying to go is a world where every time somebody in my family has a health problem, they don't actually have to call me, which is what happens today, because I am their doctor in the family. And by the way, I'm so thankful that I could be that for them. But I wish there was a world where they could get that same trust, that same thoughtfulness, and that same compassion from doctors not in their family. and it shouldn't be that you get better care if you have that doctor in your family, if you have someone inside the beltway of healthcare. You should be able to get that kind of care no matter who you are, no matter who you know. And it's just not the truth of American healthcare. So what I imagine as a world that we would all want is a world where the people that we love have somebody that they can trust with their health so that they can focus on their lives. Like I think about my 14-year-old. I mean, she shouldn't be worried about her health. She should be focusing on being a ninth grader. Same with my mom. She should be focused on being an incredibly happy retiree and not spending half her time trying to figure out which Medicare plan she should go into and what will her drug costs be. But most Americans honestly spend a lot of time on their healthcare right now, and not in the most productive ways, not in walking and eating healthy, in things that are hassles. And so how can we just strip away the hassle so that people can focus on being people and they have a support system in the healthcare ecosystem that's there for them? Now, how do we get there? That's where you get to the problems part a little bit. Well, one, we have to incentivize the right behaviors. And so, you know, as I talked about, one of the things I like about Included Health is we have very aligned incentives with the ultimate purchasers of healthcare. And we are very member-centric. We know that if we do what's right for the patient, that will ultimately get what's right for the employer. And then, you know, you can have a sustainable business model. A lot of American healthcare is not set up that way. We started this conversation about fee-for-service medicine. I mean, the incentives are all messed up a little bit. So I think working on the incentives. I think the other is simplification, simplification, simplification. We have made healthcare so confusing that even the smartest people in this country cannot figure it out. I mean, I'll just talk about myself again. Somebody in my family had a complicated medical thing come up. And this person is very intelligent, you know, has multiple graduate degrees, and was like, I mean, I just don't understand how this doctor isn't talking to this doctor. And like, what am I supposed to do? I mean, we have made this very complicated for our patients. And I think real efforts to streamline healthcare to make it as simple as possible for our patients is probably number two. So incentives and simplification, I think, will get us pretty far.
I think it's an important point you made about sort of having the doctor in your family and the advantages that come with that, right? I mean, sort of to the point of patient navigation that we talked about earlier, right? It goes a long way when you have someone in the system who might know someone in the hospital system who might be able to get you an appointment earlier instead of waiting 6 months to see a doctor. And it's challenging if someone doesn't come from those advantages. And you can, I think it's a beautiful vision for a world where you don't need those advantages to stay healthy, to not, that you don't need those advantages in order to be able to spend your time on your life rather than healthcare. It's as I mentioned, it's a beautiful vision, but I wanted to ask you sort of over the next decade, where do you see healthcare going? That's when many of our listeners will be earlier mid-career attendings, hopefully shaping this future. But I think the vision that you propose, unfortunately, is probably more than a decade out. So where do you see us going in the next decade?
Well, I do think in the next decade, technology will actually change healthcare. And I know we've probably been saying that for a long time. But I think the big moments are that I actually think unless we figure out how to leverage virtual care, how to leverage even new things like AI in healthcare, we won't actually be able to bring down the total cost of care, right? This whole like the continually increased cost of healthcare, we've tried to fix that without using technology. Like that's what bundle payments was about. I think at this point, we really do have to leverage these new tools that every other industry has leveraged to get scale. Because we're a lot of people who need a lot of healthcare. And so I think technology will be critical to bringing scale to healthcare over the next 10 years. I think another place where we will see change over the next 10 years is towards more integration. If I think about the last decade, there has been a lot of increase in like subspecialization and even like on the tech side, a lot of point solutions. Like we just treat one type of diabetes or we work on, you know, kidney disease only. But really what people want is their whole healthcare taken care of. And that's what purchasers want too. And so I think the next decade will be about more integration of services and how we have more connectivity as opposed to how we go deep on things. And so those are probably the two things I hope will change over the next 10 years, which will then get us to the vision of more simplified healthcare and better incentivized towards outcomes.
Right. I was going to say it goes back to the aligning the incentives in the end. I want to ask, you're obviously a very accomplished leader across academia, across industry. So I wanted to chat a little bit more about your specific style of leadership. And I was wondering if you could reflect across your career and tell me what you think makes an effective versus ineffective leader.
Yeah, I think the first place I always start from when it comes to effective leadership is a place of curiosity. Healthcare is complex. Being a doctor, I think, reminds you of this regularly. I mean, people surprise you all the time. There's nothing more humbling than being a physician. So stay curious, stay open-minded. You don't know where the next solution will come from. And so that's a place where I always start with when it comes to leadership, because the best leaders are those who can sit in ambiguity, sit with an open mind, and be a little bit flexible on what's going to be next. The second is being very clear on your why. And so for me, and I hope for most healthcare leaders, the why is the patients. The why is the actual people you are trying to help. So why are you a leader? You're a leader because you're trying to make healthcare better. Why do you want to make healthcare better? So that patients can actually get better every day and that they can focus on their lives. So that is key because I think sometimes leaders forget their why and then they're just leaders for the sake of being leaders, which doesn't actually, to me, resonate very much. And then the third is have a vision. Because I do worry that even as leaders, we start from a place of negativity instead of where can we actually go? And so I think you have to present a vision to people because that's ultimately how you get followership. If you just focus on what's wrong, people will agree with you and they might even work with you for a while, but they're not going to follow you over the long term because it's a marathon, not a sprint. And so you really have to know where you're going at the end of the day.
Yeah, it goes back, I guess, to the earlier question when I asked you about the problems and you wanted to talk about where we're going. I think it is about the vision at the end of the day, right? It's easy to point out the problems. It's harder to think of solutions and where you want to end up because there's many, obviously many different finishing points. So, yeah. You know, I want to talk a little bit more about your career trajectory because I think it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, it's characterized by a bunch of different themes from consulting to health policy to population health to now med tech. You know, from my vantage point, it seems to be in contrast with what a lot of physicians do, namely staying very closely to one particular track, clinical plus one something else, and then just that's the rest of their life. So I have to ask you, why have you constantly reinvented yourself across various arenas in the healthcare system? What value have you found in doing so?
Yeah, I think the good news is I don't think I've reinvented myself. I think I've mostly just stayed authentic to my goal, which is just to truly make it so that Americans can live longer, healthier lives at a lower total cost of care. And I think it's possible. And so, but I do think we're going to need a lot of different types of organizations, a lot of different types of thought in order to accomplish that. And so, you know, we talked a little bit about consulting. Consulting is phenomenal for helping you learn very quickly. How do you assess a problem? How do you prioritize within that problem? And then how do you go tackle it? Law school and med school, amazing to think about both expertise, because in healthcare, there's a lot of expertise you need. Good reminders of why you do this every day, the patient care side of medical school. And it's a highly regulated field. I mean, we are going to need people who are expert in regulation in order to ever get to the vision that I just said. I think technology is the next big thing to transform healthcare. And so it makes a lot of sense. And so for me, my path has never been determined by the name you put on it, whether it's tech or consulting or research or whatever. It's truly about where do I think I can make the biggest impact at any given moment in time. And when that starts to feel off balance, it's, you know, that's when you start to think, okay, what's the next big thing? But it's truly a forward looking career path. And that's staying curious. I mean, I think if you put the blinders on and you're like, I'm only going to work in this one space, you could miss a really big opportunity to make a lot of people better.
Right. No, it is an important, and I think it's a theme that we keep coming back to. And the streams of knowledge that you've been able to integrate and that have informed your work, and that there's really a lot of interplay and intersection between the business side of things with the expertise, with the regulation, and so on and so forth. You know, I think that nearly wraps up the episode. But before we go, I wanted to ask you for three pieces of advice you might give students who are interested in a career pathway like yours, in building towards a vision like yours. And I know we've talked about some of them throughout the episode, but if you could consolidate it here into some three endpoints.
Well, one, do it. And so I think if you are a student out there who is thinking about moving the needle in healthcare, do it. It's a really great space where you can make a lot of impact, have fun while you're doing it, and learn and grow. And so I want to encourage people to do this kind of work. The second, I think, is kind of what you've heard, is stay open and go broad. I think, you know, somewhere you're in college right now, there's probably an opportunity for you to like sit in political science classes, sit in, you know, humanity stuff. Open your aperture when you are in your early stages of your career, because you never know when something that you didn't think was related to the work you're doing is actually related to the work you're doing. So open your aperture would be my second piece of advice after actually do it. The third is always keep your why at your center. This work can sometimes get distracting. It can get really hard. It's a marathon. But if you know why you are doing it, you'll be able to stick with it for the long term and not burn out, which I think is for sure a consequence that a lot of leaders and people in healthcare end up facing.
Wonderful. What a note to end on. Thank you so much, Dr. Farr. Really appreciate your time.
Of course, Amar. Thanks again for doing this and hosting this podcast.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. You can also head to the description of this podcast to follow us on all social media so that you don't miss out on any of our content.